This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Andrew Seidel about the Supreme Court's devastation of the wall between church and state. Andrew is the author of the new book coming out in September called American Crusade: How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom. We will also speak with attorney John Filo, executive director of the Sugar Law Center in Detroit. The Sugar Law Center is handling many cases that support the rights of working people and people of color who are fighting back against corporate power. Joining me to interview John today is guest co-host Julie Hurwitz, who was the founding director of the Sugar Law Center. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. At issue was school employees' First Amendment rights to religious expression while on the job. The court held that a school district infringed on football coach Joseph Kennedy's First Amendment rights when it disciplined him for engaging in, quote, private, unquote, prayer. Kennedy was a coach at the Bremerton School District in Washington State. After games, he knelt on the field with some students joining him in prayer. That so-called private prayer occurred on the 50-yard line. The school district forbade the coach to pray on the field after games. It did allow him to pray in a private location behind closed doors. After Coach Kennedy continued on the field to give his thanks to God, the school district placed him on administrative leave. It gave him a poor evaluation despite a history of positive ones. Kennedy did not return the following year, and he sued, seeking reinstatement. He also relocated to Florida. The Supreme Court upheld Kennedy's right to pray in public on the field after the game. Joining us to discuss the Supreme Court's decision in this case and the issue of Christian nationalism generally is Andrew Seidel. Andrew is a constitutional attorney and vice president of strategic communications at Americans United for Separation of Church and State, which litigated Kennedy versus Bremerton. He's also the author of several books, including The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American, and American Crusade, How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom, which hits the shelves in September and explains a lot of what is happening at the court right now. Andrew, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Andrew, what was the Supreme Court's holding in Bremerton?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the court falsely described really coercive prayer as personal, and it blocked public schools from protecting their students' religious freedom. You know, the opinion and the whole thing, it was breathtakingly dishonest and lawless even. And it actually makes the opinion difficult to sort out because it was so dishonest. The conservative judges got the justices got the law and the facts wrong. They bought into what a Republican-nominated circuit court judge called a, quote, deceitful narrative. And then they used those alternative facts that we heard so much about under the Trump administration to attack a founding American principle, the separation of church and state. So, it really is a radical departure from the protections that school children have had for decades.
Andrew, does Bremerton reverse long-standing precedent and overrule the well-known case of Lemon versus Kurtzman? What is the Lemon test?
Oh, those are such good questions, and they're kind of scary, the answers, really. So Gorsuch didn't technically overrule the Lemon test. At least he didn't use those words. What he said was that judges should know not to use the Lemon Test because it has been ignored and criticized for so long. So essentially, he's saying Lemon is dead. But I actually think that that makes his opinion here really dangerous, because it gives the green light to even more conservative judges and even more politically motivated judges on the Fifth and the 11th Circuits, for instance, to decide cases in line with their political whims and not worry about precedent at all. Because even if precedent still stands, as Lemon does and has, if they can point to any criticism or a time when that test or case or precedent wasn't applied, then they can say what Gorsuch is saying here, that we should know not to apply that test. So I mean, really, I think we're seeing the full-on abandonment of stare decisis in favor of conservative politics here. Now, to answer your question, you know, what is the Lemon Test? This is something that the court synthesized back in 1971. So what the Supreme Court did was it looked back on all the cases that it had decided about the government using government power and resources to promote or advance or inculcate or impose one particular religion over others, or even religion generally over non-religion. And then after that survey, it formulated this simple three-part test about whether a government action crosses that constitutional line. And the test is basically this. Does the challenged government action, one, have a secular purpose? Two, have the principal or primary effect that neither advances nor inhibits religion? And three, foster excessive government entanglement with religion. And if the government action fails any one of those three prongs, then it failed the Lemon Test and had to be struck down. Now, almost as soon as the test was synthesized, it started being attacked. But that was not because there was anything wrong with the test. It was because 6 months later, the court actually looked a lot different. Two of the justices who crafted much of the precedent that Lemon was built on were gone. So Lewis Powell replaced Hugo Black, who was a strong supporter of state church separation. And meanwhile, you have Powell, who penned a memo that some believe served as the kind of master plan for the modern conservative movement. And then you have William Rehnquist replacing John Marshall Harlan II. And then later you obviously get Scalia. So, you know, over the years, these justices became a kind of core that nipped and stabbed and bit at the Lemon Test at every opportunity. But I really think it's important for everybody to understand that the Lemon Test it's a good test. There was nothing wrong with it. It was that the makeup of the court began to change, and conservative justices who were hostile to the outcomes dictated by that test were appointed. So, you know, I mean, it was a strong precedent. It was an 8-1 decision that synthesized decades of rule-defining precedent. And it itself was strong precedent that was older than Roe versus Wade. The problem has always been the court has been unwilling to apply that legal principle for fear of popular backlash. And now it's either on a shelf or overturned, depending on which version you want to go with.
Can you please discuss the court's new history and tradition test?
Well, I have some thoughts on this test. First, let me say that for this case, it actually didn't matter for the Kennedy versus Bremerton case, because whatever test the court should have applied here, if it had applied them to the actual facts on the ground, this case would have failed the Lemon Test, the endorsement test, the coercion test, you know, any one of them. And the history and tradition test is not a real test. It is a way to evade the rule of law. Basically, the history and tradition test says this. If it was acceptable or right back then at the founding or the framing, then it's fine now. So, I mean, really, this is not a test. It's retrogressive politics masquerading as a legal test. And all we need to do is think about where we would be on things like segregation or interracial marriage if history and tradition were the test. And the second thing people need to understand is that judges are remarkably bad at history. So 2 years ago, I published a law review article called Bad History, Bad Opinions, which actually shows how judges and lawyers cherry pick and manipulate history to achieve litigation goals. And this is so common that it actually has a name. It's called law office history. And in the religious freedom and church-state arena, law office history is just a plague. And that's what the article I wrote was about. It was specifically about prayer in the school context. So it's really on point for this case. And it is rampant in this context, which I document in the article. And it's also rampant at the Supreme Court right now. I mean, so the history and tradition test that we saw wasn't just in the Kennedy versus Bremerton case. We saw quite a few opinions, actually, in the last few weeks that venerate and glorify history and tradition over established legal principle and fact. So we had the Carson versus Macon case, in which the court forced taxpayers to fund religious indoctrination in education. The New York State Rifle and Pistol Association v. Bruin case, the Dobbs decision, which abolished reproductive freedom, and then the case that we've been talking about, Kennedy versus Bremerton. And in each of those, the justices glorified and venerated history and tradition because they are trying to drag us back to a time when white conservative Christian men ruled, when their rights were the only rights that mattered. And this is something that I talk about in my new book, American Crusade, how the Supreme Court is weaponizing religious freedom. I explain that the justice's overriding principle here is not reality or the law or the Constitution, but simply this: Christians win. And that is where we are right now.
And Andrew, that's the excuse that the Supreme Court, the right-wing majority of the Supreme Court, used to overrule the constitutional right to abortion, because abortion was not historically protected in the 19th century.
So they said.
That's the excuse, right.
Yeah.
In Bremerton, the court found that when the coach prayed on the 50-yard line, he was not acting in the scope of his coaching duties. The majority said it would be an excessively broad job description to treat everything coaches and teachers do and say, quote, in the workplace, unquote, as government speech subject to government control. But don't students look up to coaches as authority figures and role models? Isn't the coach the king while on the football field?
Absolutely. And that is just one of the many problems with this opinion. Students felt pressured to pray with the coach because of the authority he wielded and abused. I mean, that is in the factual record. There were amicus briefs that documented the psychology of this authority, and professional athletes and coaches who explained the role that it played in their lives. And in a way, the coach himself even admitted this when he said he was trying to make these kids into, quote, better people, right? He is wielding his power as an agent of the state. He had access to these kids because of his role as a public school official. He had access to the field because he was acting in his official capacity. Everything about this was a coach acting as a coach with power over the players. I mean, to say that this was a private moment is really just absurd.
How did the coach's language confuse the issue? He said his prayers were personal and private. Did this dissent refute that characterization?
So this really goes back to the, quote, deceitful narrative that Judge Smith warned us about at the Ninth Circuit. And I would really encourage your listeners to go read. I'll read just a brief section of it because it's remarkable to hear a federal judge write like this. So Judge Smith wrote, unlike Odysseus, who was able to resist the seductive song of the sirens being tied to a mast and having his shipmates stop their ears with beeswax, our colleague, Judge O'Scanlan, appears to have succumbed to the siren song of a deceitful narrative of this case spun by counsel for appellant to the effect that Joseph Kennedy, a Bremerton High School football coach, was disciplined for holding silent private prayers. That narrative is false. Now, I don't know about you, but if a judge wrote that about me and my candor to the tribunal, I would go hide in a hole. I would seriously question my life choices. And instead, First Liberty Institute appealed to the Supreme Court and doubled down on that narrative. That says something truly remarkable about this particular Supreme Court. And I think Justice Sotomayor's dissent here was really brilliant. She countered, the majority's mendacious wordsmithing with photographic evidence that disproved the entire basis of the majority opinion. You know, she included three pictures, and that simple rebuttal, I think, leaves the Kennedy opinion seriously vulnerable to being overturned in the future. So I have hope that we can eventually restore the law. The fact that this was an opinion based on alternative facts and so divorced from reality really ought to make it weak precedent moving ahead.
Andrew, in this case, Americans United argued that the case was moot because the coach had relocated to Florida. Americans United's principal briefs also addressed how some students are harmed when coaches instigate prayer. Please elaborate on that.
Yeah, this is kind of remarkable, too. And it sort of goes to that deceitful narrative, I think, as well. The coach sold his house and moved to Florida in the middle of this case. And his lawyers didn't tell the court. And this was 2 years ago, before he even petitioned for cert at the Supreme Court. And worse, the coach was only asking to be reinstated. That was the only remedy he was seeking. He wasn't asking for damages or anything like that. So the relief he wanted wasn't really possible, right? He and his wife moved literally across the country and bought a new house, registered as Florida voters, and talked about how they were proud to be Floridians now. And yet, the court didn't punt on the case, even though this position that he is asking to be reinstated to is less than $5,000 a year. And it's only a couple months of work. And I truly believe that is because this court and these judges are eager to decide these cases. And that is, by the way, the subject of my next book, American Crusade. I believe they are on a crusade to help weaponize religious freedom.
2 years ago, you spoke with us about the Supreme Court ruling in the case Roman Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn v. Governor Cuomo. That case reversed precedent. How did that case and others pave the way for the current Bremerton decision?
That's such a good question. And that case is also mentioned in the new book. And these are all part of the same crusade. The cases that are brought by the same conservative legal groups in the same shadow network that helped put some of these same judges on the bench. And what we have seen time and again is the conservative judges willing to rewrite facts and ignore precedent to vindicate the principle that I identified earlier, that Christians win. And you saw that in this Kennedy case, the coaching case, and you saw it in the diocese case out of New York. In both, this court is only looking at the religious freedom of conservative Christians and ignoring the religious freedom and health and safety, in the case of the COVID cases, of everybody else. But I mean, you particularly see it in the Kennedy case. The court focused exclusively on the coach and his religious freedom. And I mean, notably absent from that majority opinion was any mention of the students and the fact that their religious freedom was trampled by an agent of the state.
Andrew, the Supreme Court also decided a case from the state of Maine this term that eroded the wall between church and state. What happened in that case?
So Maine wanted to provide a public education to all kids in the state. Great. But in some districts, there actually weren't enough kids to support building a high school. Literally, the state was too rural to recommend constructing a building, a local high school. So instead, what it decided to do was give parents some money to send their kids to a public or a private school. And the program was meant to provide a non-sectarian public education. And because the state is taxing citizens and then turning around and giving that money for education, it put safeguards in place to ensure that the religious freedom of the taxpayers and of the students wouldn't be violated. And that meant that the money had to be spent on a secular education, just like what they would have gotten at a public school. And after all, the point is to provide a public education. And actually, the program, as it was challenged, was actually set up Breyer makes this clear in his opinion in the case, so that religious schools could even receive some of the program funding as long as the funds were used for a secular education, not a religious education. So the program was not discriminating against the character of the institution, which was the claim in the Espinoza and the Trinity Lutheran cases, but against the use of the funding. So really this wasn't discrimination, but a practical way to ensure a free public education. And it's important to note, a couple parents challenged this program, said you have to provide funds for us to send our kids to a Christian school too. And one of the Christian schools at issue was a place called Bangor Christian. Its educational objectives included having, quote, unsaved students to trust Christ as his or her personal savior, and then to follow Christ as Lord of his or her life, end quote. And to, quote, develop within each student a Christian worldview and a Christian philosophy of life, end quote. Now, that's not education. That's indoctrination, and that's what Justice Sotomayor pointed out in her dissent. And that's exactly what the First Amendment is meant to prevent. But Chief Justice Roberts and the five other conservatives in a remarkably poorly reasoned opinion, they gaslit the country, and they held that not funding religious education and indoctrination with public tax dollars was itself discrimination that violated the Free Exercise Clause. And I mean, it's just so remarkable to think about that, because non-discrimination is the basis for the court's opinion. The court says that it's preventing discrimination against Christians, and that's simply not true. Instead, the court is allowing Christians to discriminate and essentially forcing taxpayers to fund that. And again, the court is doing that, as we discussed earlier, by focusing only on the rights of Christians and ignoring everybody else's rights. In other words, discriminating, right? It's remarkable.
Andrew, what do you see in the future for the separation of church and state?
Yeah, that is the big question. And, you know, this court is clearly hostile to that founding principle. At Americans United, we believe that we need a national recommitment to the separation of church and state. For too long, Americans have taken the separation of church and state for granted. And I hate to say this, but we are about to get a real world lesson in what it is like to live in a country without that crucial protection. So really, this country does need that national recommitment, and AU is going to be leading the charge just as it has for the last 75 years. So I really hope everybody listening joins us.
In your excellent book, The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American, you unpack the relationship between religion and the U.S. government. What is the founding myth?
Thank you for that. The founding myth is... It has a special place in my heart, not only because it's my first book, but because it was burned by a pastor named Greg Locke in Tennessee, who was involved. He was in D.C. on January 5th, preaching for the Proud Boys on stage and talking, you know, about going to war. He burned the book with a blowtorch. So if anybody needs a good reason to read it, I think that's probably the best review I've ever gotten. The founding myth is the idea that America was founded as a Christian nation and that we were built on Judeo-Christian principles. And this disinformation has been deliberately pushed by Christian nationalists, and we're actually seeing it a lot these days. Just this week, Charlie Kirk, that right-wing activist, was talking about it. Last week, Lauren Boebert preached it at a church in Colorado. We found out that a Florida curriculum change has led to trainings, which have essentially pushed this disinformation onto teachers in Florida. And Americans United has launched an investigation of those trainings and of that curriculum. So really, the founding myth is this central tenet of Christian nationalism, that we were founded as a Christian nation, that we were based on Judeo-Christian principles, and most importantly, in their eyes, that we've strayed from that foundation, right? That we've gotten away from those godly roots. And they use that language of return and getting back to those godly roots to justify all manner of hateful and evil public policy. And as we're seeing, and as we've been talking about, even Supreme Court decisions, right? Because it's that same historical history and tradition, and the disinformation built into there is a common thread that runs between Christian nationalism and these decisions. And I do get into quite a bit of that in the founding myth and also in the new book, American Crusade.
How big a problem is Christian nationalism today?
Christian nationalism is an existential threat to the American Republic. It really is. I was very proud to organize and contribute to a report that laid out the connections between January 6th and Christian nationalism. And I worked on that with my friends at the Baptist Joint Committee, Amanda Tyler, and then talented academics and journalists like Jamar Tisby and Catherine Stewart, Andrew Whitehead, Sam Perry, and Anthea Butler. And what we showed in the report is that Christian nationalism really created the permission structure that gave the January 6th insurrectionists the moral and mental license that they needed to attack our government and attempt to overturn a free and fair election. I mean, they told us loudly, repeatedly, why they were doing this, what they believed, and why they believed it justified the attack. They told us about their Christian nationalism, and we really ought to listen to them, because if we don't, we're going to see a repeat.
Andrew, in our remaining minutes, please tell us about Americans United for Separation of Church and State and how our listeners can follow your work.
Americans United for Separation of Church and State is a nonpartisan, not-for-profit, educational and advocacy organization that it really works to bring together people of all religions and of no religion to protect the right of everyone to believe as they want and to stop anyone from using their beliefs to harm others. So we fight in the courts, in legislatures, and in the public square for freedom without favor and equality without exception. And AU has been on the front lines of this fight for 75 years. It has been the preeminent organization working to ensure that church-state separation remains that shield that protects the religious freedom for all of us. And I truly believe that we can only do that as Americans United. And that is why I'm so proud to be a part of an organization that embodies that value in its very name. And I really hope that everybody listening will join us at AU.org.
Andrew, thanks so much for your critical work and for joining us today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Maurice Sugar was a workers' lawyer and a socialist, one of the founding members of the National Lawyers Guild, the first general counsel to the United Auto Workers, and a staunch defender of working people's rights. He was also a talented poet and songwriter of political songs and poems. In the 1950s, during the height of the Cold War, Walter Reuther was elected president of the UAW. His first official action was to fire Sugar. Maurice and his wife Jane Sugar, who was an activist and union organizer of teachers, homesteaded over 100 acres of property in the Black Lake area of Michigan. At their deaths, he in the 1970s and she in the 1980s, a trust was created which formed the financial seed money for the founding of the Maurice and Jane Sugar Law Center for Economic and Social Justice in Detroit, Michigan. In 1990, shortly after the death of Jane Sugar, a group of National Lawyers Guild national leaders, including NLG founding member Ernie Goodman, former national president Bill Goodman, both trustees of the M&J Trust, and former national president Deborah Evanson, used the endowment from the Sugar Trust to establish the Sugar Law Center. it brought to life a long-standing vision of creating a national public interest project of the NLG that would tackle the critical questions of the intersection between civil rights and economic justice. The Sugar Law Center began with a primary focus on plant closings and worker dislocation, and Julie Hurwitz was the founding director. Now, 32 years later, as a nationally recognized public interest workers' law project, the work of the Sugar Law Center has expanded to take on issues of runaway corporate power, racism, community dislocation, gentrification, poverty, environmental justice, women's rights, and many others. We have the honor and pleasure to speak today with the current executive director of the Sugar Law Center, John Filo, to discuss the critical work of the Sugar Law Center in fighting back against the rise of white supremacy, corporate power, and fascism. John has litigated cases in dozens of states representing low-wage workers, communities, and injured persons on matters of employment, constitutional, and tort law. John is also a former president of the Detroit chapter of the National Lawyers Guild and a contributing author to the National Lawyers Guild's Employee and Union Member Guide to Labor Law and the Institute of Continuing Legal Education's Torts, Michigan Law and Practice. We are also fortunate today to have with us attorney Julie Hurwitz as a guest co-host. John Filo, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me. It's really an honor and a privilege to be on this show. You know, I follow closely, and it's a great service to folks out there.
John, we're thrilled to have you. We currently find ourselves in the midst of a constitutional and political crisis in the United States, with the growing strength of a right-wing, white supremacist movement that is bringing us closer to a fascist oligarchy. We have a radical right-wing Supreme Court that we can see from the past few weeks will not hesitate to put its stamp of approval on the direction our country is moving in. The expansion of corporate power, the protection of the wealthy ruling class. This court has not hesitated to overturn long-standing precedent that had recognized the constitutional right to abortion. It has trashed the wall between church and state, prevented the EPA from regulating against climate change, and proclaimed that the Second Amendment creates a fundamental right to buy, own, and openly carry firearms, including assault weapons. With that in mind, John, let us move to the specific work of the Sugar Law Center and discuss how your work fits into the larger progressive struggles to fight back against these assaults on our rights that are currently taking place. We'd like to talk with you today about two of the cases that the Sugar Law Center has taken on and how the work of the Law Center, both in and out of the courts, is critical to the fight against the current state of affairs in our country. First, I want to ask you about the case State Fair Coalition versus the City of Detroit. Please explain to our audience what this case is about.
Well, thank you for asking about that. This is an important case that really comes from the ground up. It comes from a grassroots coalition that brought us into the case to support their efforts in relation to Amazon. You know, at its most basic, the case is about the city government's sale of land to Amazon to develop a large parcel of land as a mega warehouse, and whether that sale followed the requirements of the city's community benefits ordinance. This ordinance is very unique. It's the first one in the country of its kind. Detroit residents put this on the ballot through a referendum over intense opposition from the mayor and from certain members of the city council. But they put it on the ballot without any large financial backing from any groups. They actually got passed in the city of Detroit a community benefits ordinance. What's a community benefits ordinance? It's an ordinance that says when these economic development projects happen, the developers have to sit down across from the table with local residents and come up with a plan where that project will address the residents' concerns. Too often we see economic development is simply a method to extract wealth from low-income communities. It is not about bringing that community any genuine benefits. The ordinance is to try and change that dynamic, to bring democracy to the process where those who are developing in that community have to sit down and be accountable to those community members.
John, what is the State Fair Coalition?
It's a coalition of community members, largely property owners or tenants, that surround what here was called the State Fairgrounds. It is low-income communities, working-class community on three sides of it, and then one side is higher-income residents. They have joined together and working together in a genuine coalition that is multicultural, it is multiracial, it is multi-ethnic in every sense. And they came together to say, hey, this large parcel of land that's right situated in the middle of us, when the city develops it, it should be for the benefit of all of us. It shouldn't be just for the benefit of either the developers or the wealthiest neighborhoods that are adjacent to that property.
John, can you tell us a little bit about the history of the Michigan State Fairgrounds in the city of Detroit?
Sure. The State Fairgrounds, it's a large parcel of land that's now empty in the city of Detroit. What it was the fairgrounds for the state of Michigan. At that time, it was used all the way up from 1904 to 2009 as the location of the Michigan State Fair. We had in our state one of the oldest state fair in the nation, and it really has a fascinating and interesting history. Some sense the state fair was placed where it is to give industrial workers the opportunity to experience and see some of the agricultural activities in the state. That was part of their backgrounds. Folks moved up here to work into industry, often from rural communities. Also transitioned over time to give inner city folks a real opportunity to see agriculture, something that was part of their histories, but they have been isolated from due to various racial policies, both in the South and in the North, that took black communities away from agricultural economics. But in any event, the State Fair in 2009, after a probably decade or two decades long starvation of state government, which was occurring in Lansing, our state capital, was the defunding of programs throughout state government, led to the state ending subsidies for the State Fair. That caused a crisis in the economics, and the state actually shut down the State Fair for a number of years. So when that happened, then there was a question arose what to do with this property. And this property is the largest sort of contiguous property that the city owns. And what the city has done is sold it below market value to one of the richest corporations in our country.
How did Amazon manage to obtain ownership and control over this vast piece of historic property in the city of Detroit?
Well, I think it's a prime example of disaster capitalism. They took advantage of the downturn in economics caused by the pandemic, but also the historical issues in Detroit and Detroit's government's perception that it needs economic development at any cost. Amazon plays the game quite well of playing one community off of each other to get the most benefits, the most tax breaks, the lowest amount of development costs, and that includes the largest amount of land that it can acquire at the lowest cost. What that all amounts to is whatever city is hosting Amazon's warehouse, they're significantly subsidizing it. And in this case, that subsidy took the form not only of tax breaks, but also of a below-market land transfer. The market, or the price for the land, was set by the city at substantially lower than what its value would have been if it was put out there in a bid process. That's typical of an Amazon development, and that shameless, quite frankly, given the wealth of that company to come to a community such as Detroit that needs taxes paid, that needs those jobs, but also needs fair market value for its assets. But Amazon was able to negotiate that deal with government officials over the threat of taking the development elsewhere.
So can you talk a little bit more, John, about some of these overarching issues that you've touched on with respect to the power that corporations like Amazon wield, and how this case that the Sugar Law Center is litigating impacts these larger issues of corporate expansion, movements for community benefits, racism, gentrification, and dislocation?
Sure. I think this case is really puts a real light on the contradictions we see in our economic structure right now, and the inherent racism, the inherent undermining of democracy that we see with the corporate expansion of corporate power that we've seen over the past decades into what we've come to today. I've already mentioned, I think you can see right off, it is a prime example of the that sort of shock doctrine, that disaster capitalism, where a corporate entity is taking advantage on steroids of the issues that may exist in a particular community. For us, it also has very much a real focal on the transfer of public wealth to private hands. Well, where do you see that transfer? You see it in communities of color. You see it in low-income communities where there's a predatory environment that private industry seeks to extract wealth from those communities. What is the wealth of those communities? Things like public assets, things like a state fairground, public parks, but also waterworks, a host of other things. And we've seen that accelerate here in Detroit ever since its bankruptcy, which is a massive transference of wealth. It's the same with transferring the tax issues. The tax breaks that are given just to attract this sort of development without any promise that there's going to be real tangible benefits to the people who pay those taxes, it's just unconscionable. And this is an example of that. It also ties into basic democratic principles. This community benefits ordinance that we sued under for the city's failure to comply with, that was a grassroots effort put on the ballot by citizens and passed by citizens pursuant to their city charter. And the city's in tandem with the developer just ignoring that entirely, but more than ignoring it, treating it as if citizens' rules or the rules that apply to citizens don't apply to them. It's something that I think residents should find offensive and nothing less than that. We've actually had in the city now, which this is part of the confronting this sort of idea, we're not only granting tax breaks, we're starting to allow the corporations doing these sort of developments to actually directly capture the taxes of residents. That cannot stand. We very much see our role is pushing back against that in every way we can.
Well, good for you, John, and for the Sugar Law Center. We're speaking today with attorney John Filo, executive director of the Sugar Law Center in Detroit. John, how does this case relate to the larger movements for progressive, social, and economic transformation in this country?
We do look at it as intimately related to democratic rights of citizens. The laws that are set on behalf of citizens, and it is their laws. And it is their law, particularly and most directly in this case, that we're seeking to enforce, one that was adopted by a popular vote. But then also the confrontation of the idea of economic development as a wealth extraction tool for developers, the wealthiest among us. We need to fight back against that every opportunity we can, and we need to develop models that force the developers enforce government officials who are working in tandem with them to be accountable directly to citizens. That's where we see this case tying in.
Thanks so much, John, for your discussion about this case. Now, there's another case that the Sugar Law Center is currently involved in. It's the case of Delgado versus ServPro. Could you tell us a little bit about this case and its impact in relationship to these issues on workers' rights, immigrant rights, and the fight against racism?
Okay, certainly. This is another case. You know, we're always asked at Sugar Law Center what we do, and a lot of our work translates directly to workplace safety issues, but we really look at the economic issues broadly. But I think Delgado particularly captures the workplace issues that we see and how that translates over into, you know, fundamental civil rights in a lot of ways. What this case is about is immigrant workers who were brought to Michigan to clean up after historic floodings, probably the largest natural disaster this state had ever seen, when two dams broke back in May 2020. Now, that was the time when the pandemic was, we were 3 months into the pandemic. These groups of workers were brought up, immigrant workers, and given no protections, no meaningful protections at all for pandemic. They were treated as disposable. They were all treated as independent contractors, which is just unconscionable. They all work for this company, which is ServPro, and its franchisor. They work for them, you know, throughout the year. They came, they were put up in hotels. They were given no instructions, no protocols for protection against the spread of the pandemic. Morning meetings were held on the work site in the morgue of one of the large hospitals that had suffered massive flooding. That morgue had held pandemic victims prior to the flooding, and these workers were brought in to help just clean all this stuff out. But they would hold morning meetings in these large open rooms with, you know, hundreds of workers just packed in without masks and without protections. So we got involved in that through a group called Resilience Force, which is doing a fantastic job and a very inspiring job of organizing, working to organize the workers who are involved in this disaster recovery. They're highly exploited because they're a fractured workforce, and they're often working for 3 months on intensively for 12 to or more hours every day, and then they're off for 2 months, and they go back to their home states. So the opportunities to organize are difficult to achieve, but Resilience Force is really committed to helping these workers advocate on their own behalf through workplace organizing.
John, what are the significant issues in this case that relate to the power of large corporations such as ServPro?
The larger issues we see, right, we're seeing in this, we call it a new economy. I'm not too sure how little new it is, right? What we're seeing is new forms of exploitation at all times, right? If you listen to, let's say, the business radio, you will hear constant talk of new forms of work, new ways of working, and it's often portrayed as something that is wonderful, flexible, and implies that it's at workers' choice. For what we see, for the folks that we represent, what we're seeing is new forms of work that are highly exploitive, and they're dictated from above. That's the situation with these folks who do this work. They are classified as independent contractors, which means overtime is optional. Depending on which company they're working for at any given time, whether that will be paid. There's no workers' compensation benefits. There's no unemployment insurance. And a host of other basic protections of your workplace don't apply. What that flexibility is for is not for any of these workers. It's to exploit those workers, as is their immigration status. They're looking for a workforce that they can exploit without accountability, without pushback. And it's the role of us, it's the role that, you know, I know resilience force feels, for us to help give those workers voice, to get them the opportunity for them to stand up and organize.
So, John, tell us, what is the role of the Sugar Law Center with its work on these very important cases and all the other work that you're doing in relation to the escalating assault on people's rights in both the legal and political arenas that are coming from Washington, coming from many of the states, and coming from the courts?
You know, our foundational principle is that economic and social rights are civil rights and human rights. And there, we cannot realize our civil and political rights without those corresponding economic and social rights. So we look at ourselves as part of and providing support to every movement that is in opposition to the rights of people. And so within that, you will see our work has been, we have worked to support Black Lives Matter. Though we do not do direct civil and political rights, every one of these movements that we're going to see developing and opposition to what is happening in our country, we will be a part of it. And just to give you a few examples, as Black Lives Matter, we represented workers who were organizing in their workplace around Black Lives Matter issues. For folks who wore buttons and were punished by their employer, for immigrants who participated in the Day Without Immigrants protest back when Trump was in power. But also with the abortion rights protests. We are working with Amicus. We are organizing with law professors to provide support to the work that Planned Parenthood and that hundreds of community organizations are doing throughout the country. We're doing the same thing along the threats to our democracy and those type of issues. We very much look at it as we need to be there to support the movements that are happening and that will continue to develop in opposition to what we are seeing is a, you know, a historic repression of rights coming from Washington.
John, how can our listeners follow your important work?
There's a couple ways. You know, one, directly through our website. Two, through our Facebook page is probably what gives you the most current events. But at our website and Facebook, you can sign up for our mailing list, and we will add you to that. And if there are folks who wish to volunteer time, who have legal skills or who have investigative skills or media skills, reach out to us. Send us an email, and we can find ways to connect and to work with folks and, you know, both in mutually beneficial ways.
What is that website, John?
www.sugarlaw.org. And then our email is mail@sugarlaw.org.
Well, thank you so much, John Filo, for joining us and telling us about these cases that Sugar Law is taking on to support people's struggles.
Thank you very much for having me. The work of both you, Marjorie and Julie, inspires me as well.
One, two, three, four!
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
I got to have it grooving. See, when I leave the piano, they kind of lose me. Dun, la, da, dun, 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 dun. Just follow me. Dun, la, da, dun, 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 dun. Here's letter A. Woo! Rockets, moonshots, spend it on the have-nots. That's better. Waiting through my life. truth now.